morning. Happy St. Patrick's Day. I decided to wear enough green to cover all of us, so no pinching. Like Jared said, I'm Marie Beck. I'm one of the pastors on our team. It's so fun to be serving in a little bit of a different capacity than I normally do with you today. Welcome to everybody who is joining us online. Can we just give a big cheer for everyone online? One, two, three. I also just want to say welcome back, Will, from California, and I love your haircut. That's how you come in. Okay, if you've been around for the last several weeks or you've watched the messages online, you might know that we are in a series called Peculiar People. This comes out of a passage in 1 Peter 2 where basically we're instructed to live our lives in a really unusual way. So unusual that it's noticeable to our neighbors and that it causes them to wonder about God and then in turn consider turning their life toward Him as well. To be this sort of strange and peculiar person in our day takes a radical love of God and consideration of what it looks like to deny ourselves. We're going to start in a story in 2 Samuel 11. It's about David. If you're not familiar with David, maybe you are familiar with the story of David and Goliath. So this is that David. He was anointed as a young man to be king by God. And in this story, he is the king. And in his kingness, he is just meandering around his palace rooftop one evening when he sees a woman bathing on her rooftop. He decides to find out who she is and learns that she is married to Uriah the Hittite, who is away in war fighting battle in King David's army. King David has someone bring her to him. He sleeps with her, gets her pregnant, and then when he finds out that Bathsheba is her name, is pregnant, he sends for Uriah, her husband, to be brought home from war to him, the king. Probably like to confess and repair, right? No. He has a scandal to cover up. So King David welcomes Uriah back and nonchalantly kind of asks him, like, how was the war? How you doing? And then says, Uriah, go home and wash your feet. Okay, so Uriah doesn't go home and wash his feet. He instead sleeps outside on a mat where the other servants are sleeping. And when David finds this out, he asks him, Uriah, why didn't you go home? And Uriah says to the king, because all of the men are out on the front lines. How could I go home and eat and drink and make love to my wife? As surely as you live, King David, I will not do such a thing. So David takes another shot at it, gets Uriah drunk, sends him home again. Uriah still sleeps outside on the mat. So David's in a real pickle now. So he comes up with another plan. He writes a letter, sends it with Uriah for Uriah to give to his leader in the military. And it says, put Uriah on the front lines of battle and then withdraw from him so that he'll get taken out. And that's what happens. And when Bathsheba learns of her husband's death, she mourns. And when that time passes, scripture says that David took her into his household, made her his wife, and she gave birth to their son. And then the last line of this passage says, but the thing David had done displeased the Lord. The thing David had done displeased God. I so wish I didn't relate to that passage in the scriptures. And I so relate. And I wonder, too, if you might. What have you done? Or what might you be up to? Maybe something that you were up to that seemed like a pretty okay-ish thing at first, but in the middle of the night it catches you, and you're like, ah, I'm out of alignment in sin against God. In 2004, I was driving my roommates home, and they needed to go to the bathroom. We all went to CSU at the time. And so we stopped in a fraternity parking lot, which is like such a weird story to tell now that I say it out loud. But that was true. So we stopped so they could take a bathroom break. And I waited in the car, and then they were taking forever. So I marched in there like, I have plans and things to do. So here's the scene. So there's this like foyer in the fraternity house, and then there's like split level stairs, and I can hear my roommates at the back of the top stairs. So they're talking to a guy whose back is facing me. So I go in to get him, and I walk past the guy, and I'm like, girls, we gotta go. I'm fine. It's totally fine. We can stay as long as you want. Anybody want to guess who that strapping young man might have been? Okay, it was John. That's the romantic story of how we met in the fraternity foyer. So I'm immediately, like, let me just tell you. He had just gotten home from a summer of wildland firefighting in Idaho. And let me tell you, he brought the heat back to Fort Collins. And so I was like, I don't have any plans. We'll take as long as you want. And the feeling was mutual. And we basically have spent every day together for the last 20 years. Including the first days and the first nights. And I stopped going to class and my grades started to plummet. And we partied hard and we were headed nowhere really fast. And this led to me being pregnant at 20. Today, our peculiar people topic is a community of dependence in a culture of self-reliance. Our kind of working definition for dependence is going, well, let me tell you what it's not. It's not like my dependents, my kids, who I like claim on my taxes, which is helpful. And they need me to get to school or for gas money or whatever. Not that kind of dependence, but dependence defined today as loving attachment. So we'll talk more about that in a minute, but let's talk about self-reliance. Self-reliance defined as needing no outside help in satisfying one's own needs. Some self-reliance is good, right? God gives us what we need to be able to do life. But when we take that to the extreme, we run the risk not just of missing out on the people who need us and whom we need, but also of Jesus as our lead story and who we are really fueled by. In preparation for today, I did a quick perusing through social media. My Instagram account, John has like a work Instagram account, and then the kids watch YouTube videos, so I watched through those, just trying to pay attention, like, what are the norms of our culture today? And my Instagram ads are full of things like apps that will give you peace, or weight loss pills, or one in particular, how to dress feminine over 40, which I nailed it in the green suit, right? Okay. And then eye cream after eye cream after eye cream, which clearly I click on because there's a lot of it. And then John's is like golf vacations and equipment for hobbies like golf and golfing things. And they are peddled or sold by young women wearing not much clothing, and they certainly aren't old enough to be getting ads for eye cream. And then my kids, they're directed to need like new devices, new games on those devices, new shoes, new makeup for all the trends. You get it, right? I don't have to convince us. This is the water that we swim in. We're basically just trained to click and enjoy. Click, watch another show, disassociate. Click, play another game, I just need some peace. Click, use the pornography, I just need some connection. Click, and patiently wait for two-day shipping. And when I think about David, I just don't imagine David clicked the watch now button from his rooftop or the overnight shipping button with an intent to displease God. I rarely do. I imagine that's true of you too. So what was happening with David? We don't know for sure, but I do imagine that there was some pretty convincing self-justification happening in David. Michael Hendricks, who's a friend, he's a pastor and author of one of my favorite books out there, it's called The Other Half of Church, says self-justification is weakness that masquerades as strength. Self-justification sounds like, well, we've already gone this far. Or, I'll just have one more. I'm not addicted. I'll quit tomorrow. Well, I just really need someone to talk to. Or my personal bent, I deserve it. I think it's really important for us to think about if we can find ourselves in the David story. In order to do that, we have to be pretty honest in our self-examination, because we don't all just find ourselves on our rooftops of our palaces, right? Only time I've ever been on my roof was when my teenagers talked me into getting on top of it to jump off of it onto the trampoline, which I 10 out of 10 don't recommend. No injuries sustained, but let's just say the bladder doesn't jump anymore. And John, he's only on our roof twice a year, once when I talk him into putting up the Christmas lights, and again when I talk him into finally taking them down, and there just aren't women bathing in the backyards in our neighborhood in Colorado in December. But just because we're not kings in high places, looking down at what we desire and taking it and justifying it by any means necessary, doesn't mean we aren't written into the story of David, right? And that we shouldn't therefore ask ourselves the question, what have I done, or more importantly, what might I be positioned to do that could displease God? Sometimes I think it feels like the odds are seriously stacked against us. Like self-reliance is what we're trained for, and we get pretty good at it. So I think it's good to go to another story of David when he that predates the Bathsheba story, and where we read of a really different outcome. After David defeated Goliath still, but before he was king, so Saul was the king at the time, and David had been anointed by God to be his successor. Saul put David in a position of leadership in the military, and David crushed it, and so he was promoted to a higher rank. And then the scripture says that Saul kept a jealous eye on David. So here comes the tension between the two of them. And as David rose in popularity with the people, he fell out of favor and with Saul. And Saul wanted him dead. So Saul sends assassins out after David, and David evades the attacks. And so fed up, Saul decides he's going to take care of it on his own, along with an estimated 3,000 of the best soldiers he can find. The king goes out to kill David. And while he's on his hunting trip, he, like the girls that I was with in college, needed a bathroom break. And so Saul goes into the cave, and there he is. The scripture says he's squatting, taking care of business. And David is in the same cave. This is crazy. The Bible's crazy. I was telling my mom these stories the other day, and she's like, this is real? And I'm like, really, this is real? She's like, talk about this in church? I was like, yeah, we talk about everything. So there he is, squatting Saul, and David is in the cave with his men, and his men are like, this is it, David. This is it. This is what the Lord said. He was going to put Saul in your hands so that you could do whatever you would with him. So David creeps up on Saul, the squatter, and he cuts off a piece of his royal robe. And then he keeps his men from killing Saul. So Saul gets up, leaves the cave, and he and his military start heading down the path, and David goes to the front of the cave, and David yells this, "Why do you listen to those who say David is out to get you? This very day, with your very own eyes, you have seen that just now in the cave, God put you in my hands. My men wanted me to kill you, but I wouldn't do it. I told them I wouldn't lift a finger against you, my master. He's God's anointed." Oh, my father, look at this. Look at this piece that I cut from your robe. I could have cut you, killed you, but I didn't. Look at the evidence. I'm not against you. I'm no rebel. I haven't sinned against you, and yet you're hunting me down to kill me. Let's decide which one of us is in the right. God may avenge me, but it is in his hands and not mine. I love that. It is in his hands, not mine. So different, right, than the first story where David saw and went and got what he wanted. So what was different? What was different in this story with David? David certainly in the cave could have justified killing Saul, who was out to kill him, and probably wouldn't have just been able to justify it, but have been celebrated in it and maybe even made king right then and there. So what was the difference? Was it that the moment of pleasure with Bathsheba was that much more desirable to David than the opportunity to be the king that God had appointed him to be? I don't think so. Was he afraid? I don't think so. He had 30-some men with him in the cave. Was it his love for Saul? At this point, Saul had, like, thrown spears at the guy, assassins. I just don't think that was it either. Sometimes we read these stories or hear a story like mine and John's, and I think we think about temptation and think, oh, they just weren't strong enough, David or Marie and John, to withstand that sort of temptation. But when we stay on that level, the problem with that narrative is we miss what's underneath it. And if we look harder at David in these two stories, I think that we find that it's less about what was tempting David and more about who he was trusting. Was he trusting himself or was he trusting God? So I'm wanting us to start wondering, what will it take for me to have this sort of cave-like dependence on God as opposed to this rooftop self-reliance? Our sinful desire for self-reliance is almost never overcome by the sheer force of our own determination. So often, we try to just push out sin, and then we find ourselves in the same spot. Scottish professor of theology Thomas Chalmers said, I'm going to read this in Scottish accent. Just kidding, I'm not. But what cannot be thus destroyed may be dispossessed, and one taste may be to give way to another and to loose its power entirely as the reigning affection of the mind. It is thus that we cease to be slave to our own sinful appetites. Basically, what he's saying is that as Christians, we need a vision for something more than just avoiding sin. We need a bigger vision to fill our hearts so that we can follow in the way of Jesus. And what better, bigger vision than a life touched and sustained by God himself? That's where David finds his strength. It is in God. The joy of the Lord, his enduring love for God and trust in him. David is lovingly attached, dependent on God. He says it, remember, from the top of the roof, from the front of the cave, not the rooftop, the front of the cave, and he yells down, my men wanted me to kill you, but I told them I wouldn't lay a finger on you because he's God's anointed. Like, it's all about seeing God that kept David from murder that day. Our brains draw life from our strongest relational attachments to grow our character and develop our identity. Who we love shapes who we are. And David loved God, so he could depend on him. He was lovingly attached to God. When I talk about loving attachment, picture gorilla glue, like gorilla glue to God. So if being gorilla glued to God is our goal, this loving attachment, What does it look like for us to find ourselves that way with God? If it's not just pushing out sin, like how do we do that? Julian of Norwich, she was a contemplative Christian from the 14th century. Also, we love the same clothing. She said, "Let God win you over with his pleasures, joy, and friendship, and you'll be less vulnerable to being fooled by the counterfeit pleasures of sin." Pleasure leads to joy, which leads to relationship. Pleasure leads to joy, which leads to loving attachment. So we're going to kind of park here on pleasure for the rest of our time together. What if it's true that in denying pleasure, its right place in our lives, its right place being defined by the one who created it, God? So what if it's true that denying pleasure, its right place in our lives, causes us not only to miss out on God's intended goodness for us, but also, perhaps, inadvertently leads us to putting God in the wrong place in our lives as well? Disclaimer, I'm not suggesting that we can just pleasure our way around temptation. And a biblical theology of pleasure gives us no license to enjoy pleasures outside of God's intended design, or to hoard them and lose sight of the needy, or to flaunt them and cause others to sin. And it certainly doesn't give us permission to love the gifts more than we love the giver. In 2 Timothy 3, Paul warns that people will become lovers of pleasure over lovers of God. The word that he's using in the Greek is philedonos. The first part of the word means love. The second part, hedonos, is used about 5 times in the New Testament, and it's always used to illustrate this sort of picture of people who are just completely preoccupied with pleasure and self-gratification. In Galatians, it talks about what it's like for people who are lovers of pleasure in this way, this lovers of pleasure and not lovers of God. Stick with me. This is quite the passage from Paul to the church. It's obvious what kind of life develops out of trying to get your own way at all, self-reliance. Repetitive, loveless, cheap sex. A stinking accumulation of mental and emotional garbage. Frenzied, joyless grabs for happiness. Trinket gods, magic show religion, paranoid loneliness, cutthroat competition, all-consuming but never satisfied wants. A brutal temper, an impotence to love or to be loved, divided homes and divided lives, small-minded and lopsided pursuits, a vicious habit of depersonalizing everyone into a rival, uncontrolled and uncontrollable addiction, ugly parodies of community. I could go on, Paul says. This isn't the first time I have warned you. If you use your freedom in this way, you will not inherit God's kingdom. So I think it's safe to say this is not the goal, right? We don't want to be lovers of pleasure over lovers of God. So what do we do if we've determined this isn't it? I think sometimes in the church we just over to the other side where we find asceticism, which is basically the opposite. It is a kind of practice, religious practice, rooted, I think, in Indian religions, where basically it is the denial of any sort of pleasure or indulgence for the sake of becoming more godlike, self-reliant. Jesus says that apart from him, we can do nothing. So we already know self-reliance is not the way. But what about this denying ourselves of any pleasure? In John 10:10, Jesus' words, "The thief comes to kill, steal, and destroy, but I have come that they may have life and have it to the full." Abundant life, another translation says. And another translation says that they can have more and better life than they ever dreamed of. Jesus came promising a good life. So asceticism can't be it either. So what's the third way? If these aren't it, what is the way? We'll pick back up in Galatians. But what happens when we live God's way Well, thank you for asking. He brings gifts into our lives much the same way that fruit appears in an orchard. Things like affection for others and exuberance about life and serenity. We develop a willingness to stick with things, a sense of compassion of heart and conviction that a basic holiness permeates things and people, and we find ourselves involved in loyal communities, not needing to force our way in life. That sounds like David in the cave to me. Not needing to force our way in life, able to marshal and direct our energies wisely. When we live our lives God's way, in loving attachment to Him, it is then that we can move from self-reliance into real God dependence and a willingness to risk trusting God enough to not take things into our own hands. David and we cultivate this loving attachment by enjoying God and delighting in Him, and not just in this, like, I enjoy God, like, theoretical, ethereal sort of way that's like, God, I enjoy you, God. Like, it's not pretend. It's real. But it doesn't come so naturally in our culture. So a practical and important way for us to do this is by recognizing God and acknowledging Him in the good gifts that He gives us, and not pretending like we are the giver of good gifts. Tim Keller said the fastest way to be like Satan is to try to be like God. Oof, that gets all the twos in the room. Self-reliance is a weapon of destruction. And delighting in holy pleasure is an act of spiritual warfare as it leads to loving attachment with the Father. But still practically, like, how do we do this? I'm curious if there's any drivers of a Jeep Wrangler in the room. None. There were in the first two. Yes, who is that? I can't see in the light. Who is it? Tell us your name. Gabby. We'll say it one more time. Gabby. Okay, great. So, okay. Jeep drivers, I've just known this for 3 weeks. It's really wonderful. Jeep drivers have a special wave, right? Okay, and this is the steering wheel. This is the wave. Oh, look, she gave it back to me. All right, okay. They also put little rubber ducks on each other's cars just for fun. Next time you see a Jeep Wrangler, look at the dashboard and there's probably rubber ducks on it. It's just like a club, okay? Well, recently I needed to get a new car. I've been a Subaru driver for 9 years. And John and I were laying in bed one night, and he was like almost asleep, the kind of almost asleep where he's snoring but he thinks he's awake. And all of the wives are like, yeah, how does that happen? I don't know. But I'm like, can you roll over here, snoring? And he's like, I was awake. I'm like, okay. Anyway, so I'm like, hey, babe, I think I might drive a Jeep Wrangler tomorrow. And he's like, that sounds like a dumb idea. And I'm like, well, sleep on it. Anyway, I'm now the driver of a Jeep Wrangler. And the best part about it is the wave. It's so fun. I passed six Jeeps driving Maggie to school the first day I had it. And I'm just like, oh, God is so good. This is amazing. So I don't have any ducks yet, but I'll keep you posted. Okay, so you know how it is when you make a big purchase and you start seeing the thing everywhere? We were just in Arizona. Jeeps are everywhere, everywhere, everywhere. And not just Jeeps everywhere. We're in a restaurant, college basketball's on, which just couldn't interest me any less. And there it is, right across the court, capital J-E-E-P. We're at my mom and dad's pool in Arizona, their little floaty temperature gauge thing, which in Colorado we don't need to know what those are called. But theirs is attached to a rubber duck, which makes me think of a Jeep. And then, I mean, just on and on and on. We're at the rodeo. Maggie and I are walking through the vendor booths, and there's Jeep Girl stickers. And I mean, it's everywhere. We see so much. We see so much. So I wonder what it would be like for us if we could see that much of God. and his handiwork in the good gifts that he gives us. This is a practical way to grow in our attachment to him. James 1:16 says, "So, my very dear friends, don't get thrown off course. Every desirable and beneficial gift comes out of heaven. The gifts are rivers of light cascading down from the Father of light." We protect pleasure, friends, by acknowledging the giver. It keeps us in the middle. If we cultivate a life of self-reliance, fueled by self and addicted to pleasure, we are left wanting, and it is destructive. But if we will live our lives securely attached to the Father, he becomes our fuel, his love, and his plans for us lead our lives, whether we're in the cave or on the rooftops. So our work, then, is to enjoy God in everything and to enjoy everything he gives us in him. In his book, Pure Pleasure, Why Do Christians Feel So Bad About Feeling Good?, Pastor Gary Thomas casts this great big vision, bigger than just avoiding sin, for us to grow in our loving attachment to God. Rather than seeing gifts as competitors that steal our hearts from God, perhaps we can gratefully receive them and allow God to use them to ruin us to the ways of the world. So let us fill our souls with beauty and art and noble achievement and fine meals and rich relationships and soul-cleansing laughter. When we acknowledge these pleasures, he says, we acknowledge God as a genius creator of brilliant inventions and refuse then to fall into the trap of denying ourselves God's good pleasures so that we end up deeply vulnerable to illicit pleasure. In truth, God created us for his own pleasure. And he is made glad in our gladness, and in his gladness, we are connected to him. You see? So if that's the case, it's our joy-filled duty to realize when we drink a glass of cold water on a hot day that we are being refreshed by God, and that when we sit along still waters, he is restoring our soul. And when there is bounty before us in a season of pain, that it is he who prepares the table of provision for us. And so when we see a toddler toddle, we're like, ugh, that is the wonder of God. So we take joy in him and experience the smile of his face on us when we bite into a Palisade peach, right? Or we smell the coffee brewing from our bedroom. Or we look at a perfectly opened peony. Or we sit at the table with a loved one or hug an old friend. Or share tears over a cup of tea. Or even when we see a rubber duck on a Jeep or a bottle of Gorilla Glue in the grocery store and we think, God will not forsake me. He is stuck with me and I am attached to him. So we take delight in the gifts of God and give credit to the giver. If you're here and you're listening and you think, this is a different way of seeing God than I have known. In my 20s, like I knew God, but I didn't know the loving embrace of God or what it was like to be attached to him. How it would have been so different for me had I known loving attachment. At 20, I wouldn't have been looking for love in all the wrong places. I would have known a greater love than that. So if you're here and you're like, yeah, okay, I've had God just as a no, or I've had God as a big, kind of scary, very disappointed in me figure in the sky, I want to just invite you to make a decision to turn a different way. Away from self-reliance and me as king or me as queen of my own life, to a person after God's own heart, like David, which doesn't make us perfect, but it attaches us to God, the only one who is dependable enough to be the king of our lives. So if that is you, I just want to invite you to say, God, I give you my life. Under your breath, Jesus, I surrender to you. I give you all of the cave moments and all of the rooftop moments behind me, and I step into new life with you. Pregnant at 20, I knew one thing for sure. I had ruined my life, and I had sinned my way out of God's love and any good plans that he might have had for me. But I couldn't have been more wrong. That baby is this 18-year-old beautiful young adult who sat in the front row in the last gathering. He loves the Lord. He loves you people. His heart breaks for the marginalized, and he knows that he is wildly loved by his mom and dad. God's plans prevailed. And with David, I mean, David, that was rough. Took a woman, got her pregnant, murdered her husband. And God's plan prevailed, you see? The lineage of Jesus continued. God's plan through David continued to resurrection. And in your story, I don't know where you find yourself in it, but in a story, we all are. That story of pregnant to now, that's 20 years, and they have not all been sunshine and roses. And neither were they from David on the rooftop or the cave to resurrection. But God's plan will prevail in your story too. Each week we want to put into practice what we have heard. So our weekly practice for this week is super fun. Daily, set aside time to take pleasure in one good gift and meditate on God's goodness to you. Once a day, at least. This could look like hugging a friend and noticing and thinking about God's goodness. Or it could look like pulling over on Strauss Cabin Road to see those eagles. If you haven't, you have to do that. Or it could just be lingering over a cup of tea. There's so many things. We see so much, so look for them, and then look for God in them. For Christians who live closely with God, life shouldn't be one long funeral. Dr. James Houston says it should be a festival, and Forrest Gump says life should be like a... to be enjoyed. So that's what we're going to do. The team's going to pass out chocolate to you right now. And this is how we're going to wrap up our time together. It's going to happen kind of quickly. As soon as you get your chocolate, go ahead and unwrap it. These are from Kilwins. This is not gold coin chocolate. This is like truffles from Kilwins chocolate, which while they're passing out, I'll just tell you. Holly is the woman who owns Kilwins in Old Town. She's local and lovely. So let's support Kilwins, okay? Great, she knows we're eating chocolate in church today and thinking about God. I don't know what she thinks about that, but. Okay, we're not gonna quickly eat this chocolate like when we eat our emotions, if you're like me. We're gonna eat it and savor it and think about how kind of God it was to dream up chocolate for us and taste buds and family. And so everybody, maybe raise your hand if you don't have one. Okay, we're getting closer. I haven't had one in the last two gatherings because I didn't know if I'd be able to talk with it in my mouth, but I think I'll have one with you. Okay, as we enjoy our chocolate, I'm going to close us by reading a psalm from David. Everybody ready? Take a bite and enjoy chocolate. I lift my praise to you, my God, O my King, and bless your name into eternity. Your beauty and splendor have everyone talking. We compose songs on your wonders. Creation and creatures applaud you, O God. Your holy people bless you. They talk about the glories of your rule. They exclaim of your splendor. God, who gives a hand to those who are down on their luck, gives a fresh start to those who are ready to quit. Generous to a fault, you lavish your favor on all of your creatures. Our mouths are full of chocolate and of praise to you, O God. Let everything within us bless his holy name. Amen.